Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Oz podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm the editor of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an indie press that publishes socially conscious literature. Today, I'm with my usual podcast hosts, co-hosts, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger. We're going to discuss two works. We're going to discuss Otessa Moshfegh's My Year of Rest and Relaxation, and we're going to compare that, and I hope Chris and Hans do a better job of this than I can do. We're going to compare that to David Foster Wallace's novella or long short story, The Suffering Channel. So, Hans, these were your picks. So
yeah,
I thought,
yeah.
You know, like, why don't you give us the skinny?
Sure. Well, I can start by just doing a brief introduction of what both works are about, and then I'll talk a bit about the why I found them interesting, why I thought that they were at least on a surface level, kind of, there were some similarities that maybe at a deeper level are illusory. But anyway, so My Year of Rest and Relaxation is a novel about a woman. I don't know if she's ever identified by name in the novel, but the narrator is in a period of, she's a wealthy New Yorker whose parents have both passed away. She's an only child, and following their death, she's gone into this period of very deep despair and is, with the assistance of this kind of comically unscrupulous, incompetent psychiatrist, she is essentially medicating herself in such a manner that she mostly sleeps, and when she does not sleep, does really very little besides watch bad movies on VHS repeatedly.
Oh, I don't know about these bad movies. All these movies were from my childhood. The Fugitive, Harrison Ford. Come
okay.
on.
Well, let me reframe that. She watches.
I mean, Jumpin' Jack Flash is actually delightful.
She watches middle brow commercial film on VHS repeatedly.
All right, I accept middle brow.
Okay. And at some point, she discovers one of the medications she's been prescribed by her doctor. This particular one is fictional, even though most of the other medications that she gets are real. There's a particular medication her doctor prescribes her that will cause her to have long blackouts where she will she'll go shopping, she'll buy things, she'll interact with people, she'll go to clubs. 3 days later, she'll kind of burst back into consciousness and not remember any of it. And as kind of a final self-purification, spoilers, I guess I'll say now for anybody who hasn't read this, this will be a very spoiler-heavy podcast, so read these books and then come back. But at the end of this sort of year, she stages an experiment with the help of a performance artist named, I believe, Ping Yi. Sort of like an avant-garde performance artist. She stages an experiment where she essentially locks herself in her apartment and goes into a string of these blackouts and has him come over and tend to her just enough to ensure that she continues to survive. And then he paints her while she's in while she's unconscious under the influence of this drug. And this is all happening over the course of basically September 2000 to September 2001. So there's this looming shadow of 9/11 kind of in the reader's consciousness. And one of the main characters is her best friend, Riva, who is this kind of self-loathing, shallow, very stereotypical kind of character who works actually in the World Trade Center, right?
That's a pretty intense description of Reba, who I actually felt a lot of empathy for. But
well,
we can
I
get
mean,
into that.
And,
Go on.
And I think as a reader, certainly, where most readers are going to feel more empathy for her than the narrator does, right? one of the dynamics in the novel is the narrator kind of keeps her around, lets her come around out of it seems like either maybe some kind of very, very deeply buried loneliness or just out of, you know, being too apathetic to actively stop being friends. In many ways, she's a much more sympathetic character. Reva is a much more sympathetic character than the narrator is. But anyway, the last page of the... Essentially, I think it is really just the last page of the novel is the narrator watching someone she thinks may be Reva jump to her death from the burning World Trade Center. So that's my year of rest and relaxation. And then the David Foster Wallace novella, The Suffering Channel, this is from his collection Oblivion, which was published, I believe, in 2004. So this was written a lot more, with a lot more recent proximity time-wise to 9/11. And so The Suffering Channel is about a journalist who is interviewing and writing a profile about... The journalist is Skip Atwater. And Skip is interviewing and writing a profile about a man who poops fine art. Fine art sculptures made of his own feces just come out of his anus. Or at least that is the assertion that he and his wife are making. And it's really his wife who is publicizing it, right? The wife, the sculptor, you might call him, is named Brent Moltke. And his wife, Amber, is very ambitious to achieve fame and celebrity and attention and is trying to leverage these butt sculptures to do so. And the name, The Suffering Channel, it's a new cable channel composed entirely of video and images of people suffering. And as a tie-in with this article that Skip Atwater is writing about the butt sculptures, there's going to be The Suffering Channel is going to take a live recording of Brent pooping these sculptures, which he's very shy about his bathroom habits, so having to defecate with that level of scrutiny will be very uncomfortable for him, hence the suffering. And the offices of the magazine that Skip works for are in the World Trade Center, and most of the employees there will die in 9/11. And this is, again, the events of the story are all happening in the run-up to 9/11, but 9/11 itself takes place... essentially, the story ends on September 10, right? The if I remember right, the period in which the day on which Brent has to defecate on camera, I think, is September 10th. So this all kind of the arc of it ends actually even before he has to defecate on camera. So it's uncertain what'll happen with that, but in some sense, I mean, who cares? Because the whole magazine is just going to be destroyed the next day anyway, right? And I think the similarity between these two, there are a couple obvious surface level similarities, right? The big one is that they both in some sense are 9/11 stories, right? But they're 9/11 stories in which the actual fact of 9/11 happens either on the last page or not at all, right? So they're 9/11 stories, but they're 9/11 stories that don't quite...
Well, they use the idea of 9/11.
They use the idea of 9/11. They have a series of events whose color and nature and experience is shaped by the awareness of 9/11 coming, but they...
Right.
In both cases, 9/11 is this phantom that changes the context of what in some ways are relatively low-stakes, silly stories, right? And they also both, in some sense, are about art in this very strange, perverse way. So, and those were, I don't know, I mean, I'm not sure how much those two threads are tied together necessarily, but more than anything else, I think just the technique of invoking 9/11 in a way that writing about this sort of, you know, the last little bits of life before 9/11 in the shadow of that thing kind of looming, that technique was what struck me, right?
Right.
Because I haven't really... I remember when I was in grad school, I would think sometimes... World War II, right? World War II was so... There's almost no... And I mean, I'm sure this is the kind of broad statement that when you make it, people can poke all kinds of holes in it. But I remember thinking that World War II and the Holocaust are so deeply woven into the landscape of postmodern fiction. And there are almost no authors who, you know, were great and received acclaim in the mid to late 20th century that didn't have a World War II book or a Holocaust book, right? That's something that was, that event, for very, very obvious reasons, was very woven into the very basic texture and fabric of mid to late 20th century fiction. And one of the kind of questions that we asked ourselves a lot, or that I remember us asking ourselves a lot, maybe I'm overemphasizing the importance of it, but there was the question when we were in school of, like, what comes after postmodernism, right? What is post-postmodernism? Are there going to be, is the, now that everything's kind of been fractured by the internet, maybe there won't really be movements where you can categorize a whole half century of literature under one heading, but if there is, what is post-postmodernism? And part of that question for me was, well, if World War II is this thing that kind of conceptually catalyzed postmodernism and that is very woven into most of the great texts of it, is 9/11 the same thing for American fiction? And if not, how does 9/11 function in American fiction, right? And all the novels I read that dealt with 9/11 in fairly direct ways were disappointing, right? Like Extremely Loud, Incredibly Sure. Close, that's sort of a mawkish bullshit novel, right? Or at least, I haven't read it, but my sense is it's broadly regarded as sort of mawkish bullshit.
That's hilarious.
Don DeLillo's
Falling. That's this mawkish bullshit novel that I haven't read.
Maybe I should have before I said all the stuff I just said. The other thing I was going to say is Don DeLillo's Falling Man, right? Like, maybe his weakest novel. Probably the only Don DeLillo novel I haven't reread. Sorry, Patrick, you were going to say something?
No, I was just going to say it looked like a mawkish bullshit novel to me, but I haven't read it either. So,
so it was interesting to me that it's almost like there's not. I haven't encountered any fiction that has any way. It's like fiction isn't yet able really to address. It's not at a point yet where it can address that event or the after effects of that event, right? All it can do, the things that I've seen it most compellingly do are just kind of linger in the shadow of what came before that event. And I find that interesting.
Well, how about this? Because, like, in these novels, 9/11 is pretty explicitly a device, whereas in Falling Man and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, it's not really, it's using the historical event and addressing it kind of explicitly. Mm. I was curious, what do you have to do in a novel in order for it to use 9/11 in this way? Like, because both of these stories could stand, I actually didn't realize that, I didn't put two and two together in, my year of rest and relaxation until probably the last like sixth of the novel.
That was actually I had the same issue except with the Suffering Channel.
Yeah.
Like I didn't see the connection to 9/11 until I don't even freaking remember. I don't even know when I saw it.
And it's fairly subtly portrayed, right? There's a point where I think about halfway through, there's some passing reference to one of the employees at Skips Magazine being one of the few lucky people who by chance will survive the event which sends the whole magazine into history. And I think that's about halfway through. But I mean,
yeah.
But maybe, I don't know, like it's fairly subtle. And, you know, if you had read that, without the frame that I just put around it, you might think, okay, well, maybe there was, you know, a shooting or something, right? Like,
and it, yeah, there's a passing reference to someone dying in 10 weeks. I thought it was like cancer. I had the same experience with the suffering. I actually was not really clear at first what brought these two stories together, and I did eventually realize the thing is my year of rest and relaxation, just an aside, I haven't read a book in one sitting in forever, but I read that book in one sitting. I really loved that book.
Yes,
and it didn't
yes.
It really surprised me how much I loved it. And it struck me as interesting that it used 9/11 in that way. And because I was enjoying it and really getting a lot out of it, even without the 9/11 ending, without that trajectory, without that hook at the end. But in the end, I think that it earned it, and I liked it. I was just curious.
Are you talking about year?
Yeah, year.
Okay.
I really enjoyed the Suffering Channel too. I'm not sure that the Suffering Channel. I would say just on like a sort of an abstract, like really to abstract the value of the Suffering Channel and year. I feel like the Suffering Channel needs 9/11 a little bit more.
Yeah, that's
it needs
fair.
That like it needs that device, needs that endpoint, you know, because like it's so bizarre and funny and wacky, and these characters are, you know, like the people who work for this like publishing agency are just so vapid, and the man and wife, the wife is amazing. Anyway, all of that, the story is really engaging, but like 9/11 is like this anchor point that in the future that just sort of like does something to the story. I was just curious, what do you have? Because you could take any story and just sort of like put it before 9/11. And what would make that mock? What would make that not good? Like how did these stories earn it?
Well, I actually thought the Moshfegh's use of it was not good.
Really?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's a great novel. I really enjoyed it. But all you really need for a character kind of wrap up or some resolution to Moshfegh's novel is Reba's death, right? You just need her to die so that, you know, the narrator can kind of have this this revelation or whatever at the end. And
what is her revelation at the end? How would you characterize that?
Well, she said that it's something like stepping
she's
out.
Awake.
Yeah, being awake, stepping out. And agree, you know, it plays on, you know, it riffs off of, you know, the famous imagery of the people falling headfirst out of the World Trade Center. But it doesn't necessarily have to be, like, the words she used don't necessarily have to be framed that exact way for the narrator to have the same revelation of needing to be awake. You know, provided Reva dies somehow and, you know, this causes the narrator to feel like, well, I need to be conscious, you know, regardless of how shitty or whatever my life is, I need to be conscious. So I don't know. I didn't feel that. I didn't really feel like the whole 9/11 thing brought much to my year of rest and relaxation. Just because maybe it was just at the end. It's like, I realize we're in New York. We know the time, but
I wonder if it would be. I'm just trying to think about that, right? About like how earned that is, or what the defenses are for it. And I wonder, I mean, this is getting a little bit into author intention and process, and maybe those aren't relevant. But I wonder if, I mean, if you imagine the story, there are things about the story that, there are trappings of the story that make it really have to happen in New York, right? It has to happen in this kind of, it has to happen in the context of this kind of vapid, pretentious modern art world, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And if it's going to happen in New York, and it's going to happen, I'm not sure. There's something about the story where, like, the time frame of the late 90s, early 2000s feels very important, right? There's something about it where, there's something about, you know, like, at some point her VCR breaks, and that's very, it's very important to her when her VCR breaks, right? And
absolutely,
there's some aspect of it where part of what she's doing, part of what she's doing is, like her, there's sort of an elegiac quality in particular to the her, like her engagement with 90s physical media, where like part of what she is, part of how she's expressing her grief is in even kind of refusing to upgrade to DVDs, right? I'm exaggerating a little bit there, right? But there's like, one of the things that she's doing is kind of clinging to media and culture from the late 90s as a way of kind of, you could read as a way of trying to avoid accepting growth or change or moving forward, right? And so that it has to be, you have to set the story in New York, and to have her engagement with 90s media and culture, you have to have it somewhat in the past to have that kind
sure.
of, to have that as a character device and that elegiac quality. And if you're going to have a story that's set in New York, and you're going to have it set far enough back that those kinds of cultural signifiers are there to be available, I wonder if you could, it would be strange for it not to address 9/11, right?
Mm.
And I do think that there are other ways that the narrator could have earned that. I think there are other ways maybe that the narrator could have found whatever perspective she gets from watching Reva jump out of the building, certainly. But it's like if you have the setting, like the setting and those kinds of details play so much into the mood of the story, and then once you have those, it's very hard to not have 9/11 either.
Sure. I see what you're saying. I still would say, but of course, you know, then we're going against, you know, what you said earlier, which is that novels that actually deal with it or deal with it straight on or more explicitly always fall forward. Well, so I don't know whether I don't know.
So I kind of felt like I kind of have a question for you, Patrick, at the end of this specifically, because
cool.
I feel like I think that the relationship between, like, the story, the rest and relaxation, for to me, doesn't need 9/11
right.
to function
right.
mechanically the way that Suffering Channel does.
Agreed. Completely agreed.
Yeah.
But I do feel like, and maybe it's too, maybe my understanding of this is too glib, I'll pivot my question. Because, like, I only highlighted one line in my copy of Rest and Relaxation, maybe because I was enjoying it so much I just didn't think to, but this is when she decides at the end to basically make that arrangement with Ping Yi to and it's very,
how's Ping,
I mean it's
how's
Ping
it
Z, Ping, it's X-I.
X-I. The narrator of the audiobook always said Ping Shi. So I didn't know whether it was...
That might be right.
We'll just call
it
Ping.
But anyway, go on. Yeah, Ping.
Ping.
Sounds good.
Yeah. I'm very happy that I want to listen to it too, but I'm very happy that I got the Kindle copy of it. So she's making this arrangement. This arrangement is really, it's really disturbing. Like,
With Ping.
Yeah. To basically
yeah,
give, you're basically giving another person a key to, and the permission to lock you in a room for I think it's about 4 months at this point.
And the guy's a weird creepo who, like, jacks off onto his paintings and says,
yeah,
you know, death, yeah, and death in developing country X or something.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Like, and he's obviously very, you know, like, he's very avant-garde and maybe a little unpredictable, and you're giving him, like, carte blanche permission over, you right. know, basically, like, she's only awake for a few hours every 3 days.
But she's conscious. On a pretty destructive path, so.
Yeah, so, this is where she decides to do it. She says, at the end of my hibernation, I'd wake up, I imagined, and see my past life as an inheritance. Mm. And, so going back to what you said, Hans, like, 9/11 might not mark, maybe it doesn't mark, like, a point where we enter into a new, like cultural epoch.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but it is sort of like a historical singularity, like the Holocaust, right, in right. which, like, there is this very clear before and after.
Is it a naked singularity?
Well,
go on. You know. I'm being an asshole.
Right.
No, that was pure butthole. Patrick.
Like, there's the idea, I think, being, well, there's a glib reading of the book, right, where in some sense we were like the whole country was hibernating before 9/11, and then after 9/11 they stopped, right? And that's not probably the right reading, but it's kind of like, it's right. you know, if I were a sophomore undergrad reading. Writing a paper about this book, that's the reading I would go to, right? Because it's the
sure.
it makes the metaphor. It's the easiest metaphor, right? I think yeah. partly because there's a myth that we've sort of tried to develop a little bit about 9/11 for a while, that you know, before 9/11 everything was. Before 9/11, we were all super upset about rap lyrics and whether or not the president got oral, because we didn't have any real problems, and we were kind of in this, like, we were in this bubble of fake angst that was based on complete, by current standards, complete safety and privilege, and now we have real problems. And, I mean, that's kind of a shallow, fake narrative, right?
Well, it's total bullshit.
It's total bullshit, but it's a particular type of bullshit that had some prevalence for a certain amount of time before it became pretty clear that, you know, we're still just as wrapped up in bullshit as we were in the 90s, except now, in addition to that, we also have problems. So it's like...
I would say that another... maybe it's just as glib, is that she goes into her year of rest and relaxation after experiencing, you know, several, I mean, they're not like singular traumas, but she has lost her parents. She has, this really awful relationship with this guy and is just on the whole, retreating. And I don't know, I kind of felt like you could read, and I think that it's too simple to read it this way too, necessarily. But, like, not that we're awake after 9/11, but that we're actually occupying that same space that she was during her year when she's looking at the world around her and thinking, God, how stupid and vapid everyone is. They don't really know the truth. The truth is terrible, and that's maybe that rings more true to me about, like, the space that we're in now, where we are actually more heavily dosing ourselves and retreated, or in a state of retreat. But so I don't know.
That's interesting. I like that.
It's interesting too. Like, one difference between these books is they were, I don't know for sure when The Suffering Channel particularly was written, but it couldn't have been written any later than 2004, right? Because that's when the collection came out, Oblivion. And
unless Wallace is a time traveler.
Right, And
I think what you said is it rings true.
Is there
could not
is there
could
some,
not have come after 2004?
Is there some fanboy theory that he actually was a time travel?
Chris.
I'm just letting Hans know that his understanding of how the universe works is spot on.
Chris is just fucking with me because he thinks I over-explained something that was obvious.
Well, I appreciate that you explained it to me.
Right, right. So Suffering Channel came out in 2004. My Year of Rest and Relaxation was published in 2018, right? So there's... Even though that sort of motif of things happening in the shadow of 9/11, which happens on the last page or by implication about 20 pages after the last page, that there's 14 years of perspective that have occurred between those two, right? Mm. And with the Suffering Channel, again, with the Suffering Channel, one... maybe too glib, too easy, too simple idea that might have been easier to believe in 2004 was, like, everything in the Suffering Channel is, the concerns of that story are fundamentally ridiculous, right? It's a guy who's working for a magazine that is basically a slightly more upscale version of People or something like that, right? It's People with one more layer of respectability kind of slopped on top of it. And, you know, the Suffering Channel is the thing, the channel, the cable channel composed of people suffering is probably something that you would have seen much less of a market or an audience for after 9/11, right? It's like a slightly more upscale version of an old Faces of Death video. A more intellectually respectable version of an old Faces of Death video. And so there is a sense of, like, there's a reading that you can construct of that as kind of people playing in the last scraps of the silliness and shallowness of late 90s culture before kind of all being forced to really accept the gravity of the world as it really exists, right? Or again, to get real problems. And I don't know if maybe that's also an oversimplification of that work. But that was this is the third time that I've read it. And the first time that was an interpretation that was hard for me not to have. The second and third times I may even on rereading have become less sure what it was trying to say. Patrick, I'm curious. You haven't really talked. You, I believe, haven't talked much about the Suffering Channel. I'm just curious how you felt about it, what your responses were to it. I'll admit, I really like David Foster Wallace. I've read everything of his. Oblivion is my favorite of his short story collections, and I was looking forward to rereading this. Like I said, it was the third time I've read the story, and I maybe did not find that it held up on reread as well as I expected. Again, particularly next to My Year of Rest and Relaxation, which is so confident and amusing and is snappy in a way that Suffering Channel isn't. Mm. And also that the ridiculousness of it, I found to be more of an impediment to being moved by it than I did when I was 28. I was just curious how you reacted to it. I remember thinking, this isn't as good as I remembered. It might get a bit slagged.
It's actually, that was actually a question that I had. I remember you guys talking when we were talking about Catch 22. Mm-hmm. The podcast isn't up anymore. But when we were talking about Catch 22, and you guys were like, it's too obvious about this. This guy who's, you know, he's obviously satirizing capitalism and it's too obvious. And I was reading this and I was like, this seems pretty fucking obvious to me.
The satire here is not subtle.
Right. And so I wondered what the difference was. But, you know, also...
I'm not sure there is a difference. It hasn't aged me that well, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. At the same time, so, like, thematically, it seemed very, pretty much open to me. you know, I knew that it was talking about 9/11 because of the framework that you'd given it, even though I found it extremely difficult to find that in the story. In fact, after I read it, I had a PDF. I you know, just did like a scan on my desktop for dates and for like words like World Trade Center, and World Trade Center comes up once. September 10th comes up one time. So at this, while it's obvious, I also found it very difficult. Not just for it's kind of laissez-faire way of connecting with the September 11th idea, but also, you know, like as I was telling Chris, like, you know, what it kind of chooses to focus on in between the main narrative of Skip trying to get the shit sculptor to sign on and eventually do, you know, do his shitting live. I found that kind of strange and hard. Basically, the bottom line is I found it hard to follow.
Mm-hmm.
I found it a difficult story to kind of go with, narratively speaking. And I think that, and also as I was saying to Chris, I genuinely wish I found David Foster Wallace funny.
Mm-hmm.
I really do, because I think if I found him funny, I would find him easier to follow. And I think he has a lot of interesting things to say. So, basically that's where I am with the novel, which is why I'm not talking as much as I wish I could.
Well, and again, this is not, I do believe this is not his best work, for what that's worth, but
sure.
Well, on your third read through, Hans, was there a part that still kind of impressed you, or that held up?
Well, it's got a certain vividness to it, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
The characters, the settings are, there's a quality that Wallace has, at least for me as a reader, where he's so wordy, but at the same time there's this momentum that his sentences and paragraphs have that kind of fling you through these long wordy things, right? And where his imagery is they feel very, imagistically vivid in a way that a lot of that kind of line level dense work might not be, right?
Mm.
And I think partly that's because he's very good at repeating similar images, similar observations with a little bit of difference, right? Like there's, and that still was impressive to me. Just the kind of rash weirdness of it, I still found admirable. You know, it's not, I mean, I can't imagine, I'm trying to think of another writer that I can imagine coming up with the basic hook of, you know, this journalist for a kind of slick magazine investigating a guy who may or may not be pooping sculptures, and his wife is this kind of fame-obsessed, enormous but beautiful sociopath. Like, that's not, you know, an idea that Cormac McCarthy would have, right?
No.
The only other author I can think of who
An awesome idea, too.
The only author I can think of who maybe would come up with that is, I don't know, like Chuck Palahniuk, maybe, but he would write it so differently.
Right.
So just the kind of the disjunction between style and subject matter, I thought was interesting in that regard. It has some genuinely interesting observations about bodily functions, right? Like one of the running threads is these different characters sharing observations and thoughts about their relationships to their bodily functions. And I found those to often be moving and amusing and human in a very original way. There's a sequence where there's an anecdote that's just kind of told in passing about, and it's not really touched back on in any way other than just kind of being thematically important. There's an anecdote that's told in passing about a recently divorced man who goes on a date with someone else who's, you know, recently got out of a relationship, and they go back to her apartment and she says, look, I have to take a shit and I can't do it with you here. I need you to leave, but you can come back when I'm done, right? And he's like standing outside looking up at her window thinking, this is the first moment of human connection that I've felt in months. Like understanding and sympathizing with her anxiety about like needing to go to the bathroom but not wanting him to be there in the apartment when she does it. And that little vignette stuck with me for a long time. That little vignette would pop back into my head and I wouldn't remember where it came from, and I would find it very moving and wish I could track it down. And then I think when I reread Oblivion a few years after I first got it, so that all that stuff worked for me and still works for me. As to what didn't work for me, I think partly just the kind of thematic incoherence of it that we've both touched on. There's something about the way that, I don't know that in 2019 anybody would write that the poop sculptor's wife, Amber. I mean, she is a very interesting character, right? But one thing about her is she's very large, and like her largeness is kind of used as this running joke. And I don't think anybody would write that in 2019, right? Like that.
Yeah, definitely not. That was something that I remember kind of being like, that seems a little iffy.
It's a bit off-putting, right? And it's too bad because if you remove stuff like, you know, the car axle sinking into the mud on the side that she's sitting, if you get rid of the way that it's turned into this surreal, implausible gag, right, then she is actually a very interesting and compelling character. But that bit, I think, he happened to write that right around the end of the time when that was something you could get away with.
Right.
So, yeah, that's how it was a mixed bag for me, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah. I liked it a lot. I thought that, I guess, like, I can see how maybe it's a really good first read if you're not Patrick Barney. But my first time through it,
You think I'm the only person in the whole world who
probably not. There's probably a couple other people, but I don't want to name anybody else on this podcast. So
I think, as I remember, the Wikipedia article on this book cited some reviews that kind of singled this one out as a little bit of a dog, for what that's worth. I think you're certainly, Patrick, you're not the only person who didn't like it.
Well, I'm not, and I don't want it to come off like I'm trying to rag on Wallace or anything.
No, that's fine.
I genuinely believe that, you know, whenever I've read his work, I'm like, this guy is fucking talented. I just wish I got his sense of humor because he's you know, on the prose level, like you're saying, Hans, he's fucking great. He knows what he's doing.
So this story needs 9/11 more.
Absolutely.
I said that it feels it. It feels like it needs 9/11 more. Does it earn it? Does it earn the use of 9/11 as the? I mean, like, really, is like the thing that makes this? Because without 9/11, it is just shit, kind of. Really, I mean, like, it is just a long poop joke with
some fat jokes thrown
probably
in.
With some fat jokes, and, you know, my favorite stuff was the jump cutting between the editorial office or the office at Style and Atwater and the wife in the car. And that was great. That was hilarious. I know it was a lot of, you know, probably the fat jokes didn't bother me as much because he did give her so much agency and so much mystique.
Sure.
I felt like it was just another aspect of her just being so she's a force of, of nature and will and kind of amazing.
Right.
So I kind of felt like that was enough to sort of fold in this other like physical aspect of her. But all that aside, without 9/11, this story is just really like it has nothing that holds it together and gives it any seriousness at all. So does it earn it though?
Well,
like does that make?
I don't know why not.
Is that a silly question?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, the question. So if I'm going to try to quote exactly what you just said here, it needs 9/11 to hold it together and give it something, right? How does 9/11 hold it together, and what does 9/11 give it?
That's a good question.
If you can answer that question, I think that's kind of the question that I brought to the podcast, right? And we've thrown out theories. I don't know if you want to commit to any of the theories that have been thrown out.
Well, let's think about that. So for it to need 9/11, then the idea of a guy who shits sculptures, who shits fine art, to, you know, rise to the form of satire, then it's gotta have to have 9/11 to earn 9/11, right? If that makes any sense. What I'm saying is,
right.
So if we don't recognize that the story is, you know, talking about our vapid entertainment and arts culture in this country without 9/11, if we don't recognize it without 9/11, then I guess it needs 9/11. But
well,
I wonder if maybe it
just needs 9/11 as a. It's like if you, and this is not a particularly kind reading of the story, I suppose. It's not kind to Wallace as an author, right? But like, if you don't have 9/11 at the end, then you actually have to investigate the question of, is this guy really pooping sculptures? And you have to investigate the question of, is he going to be able to get out of his wife's terrifying clutches? And the... From a sheerly kind of pragmatic device-oriented standpoint, 9/11, aside from kind of highlighting the shallowness of the thing that it satirizes, it's also a nice way to get out of having to end the story.
Right.
It's a little bit like the Sesame or the Muppet Show sketches where you know Animal right. just blows everything up at the end.
Right. Okay. So. Yeah, that makes sense as like an unkind reading, you know, if you're being unkind.
Well, and more, I mean, as somebody who's read a lot more of Wallace's work, there's a technique that he uses often of he'll have a long story or a long novel that builds and builds and builds to some kind of climactic event and then stops before that climactic event. And that's one thing people find really aggravating about him, right? Like Infinite Jest is 1,000 pages long and it's building up to a big confrontation between these two groups of characters, which it then stops before they actually confront each other, right? Which is almost like a metafictional device. It's a way of saying, okay, well, the things that you want to be invested in following the story actually aren't important. Now you have to think about what it is I was trying to say with the characters and the lead up. But I mean, you can understand why a lot of people find that intensely aggravating. And there's other stories at least one other story I can think of in this collection that used that device, right? So it's to some extent a variation on a habit that he has in how he structures the progression of his work.
So I kind of want to, I don't want to make this like a game, but like we're making light of 9/11, but I was curious if we just took a story and we said, what if this happened
right before 9/11
and the right before 9/11, what does it do to the story? So
that's
like, what's
thought.
A,
so like,
yeah. So
naked. Well, yeah. I know that you didn't read this, Chris, but Naked Singularity, right? Is set in New York and is about these kind of, it's about one person gradually going insane in relationship to his frustrations with the court system. And if that ended with 9/11, well, that would be off a little bit, I guess, because, I mean, with Naked Singularity, with Naked Singularity, the things that that character is invested in and cares about truly are important in the moral framework of the novel, as opposed to Suffering Channel, where it's shit sculptures, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that partly answers the question.
And I wonder if, like, adding a dose of realism to the end of A Naked Singularity would kind of defeat the point, since if we're correct, Hans, a lot of the narrative that goes on is actually not real.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a more trenchant example. Moby Dick. If Moby
See, this is what I was worried about.
Yeah.
I was worried about asking. I knew as I was asking this question. I was like, God damn it. This is going to go bad.
Then 9/11 happened, and we all said, who gives a fuck about the whale? We have more important things to worry about.
Oh, my God. I knew it. I knew I shouldn't ask that question.
Underworld by Don DeLillo. You guys haven't read Underworld by Don DeLillo. But that's a New York
I read
novel.
The novella at the beginning, but...
I have read other novels by Don DeLillo. Let's use those.
Well, all Don DeLillo's novels are... I can't say that word. Many Don DeLillo novels... He likes New York, right? Like a lot of authors do.
Sure.
Something like... You read Mao Too, right, Patrick?
Yeah.
I suppose Mao Too... in some ways, I guess, actually... 9/11 was a culmination of a lot of trends that Mao Tse was recognizing, right? I mean, that novel is about terrorists, and it is
about...
So if you ended it with 9/11, I guess it would change the thematic resonance of it, because Mao Tse actually ends, as I recall, with this sort of scene of joy and celebration that is initially presenting itself as violence, right? The tank that turns out to be part of a wedding procession, and, you know, the groom pops out of the tank and waves at somebody on a balcony, right? So you would have had to end if you had 9/11 kind of on, you know, the page after the end of Mao Tse, it would totally change. It would be thematically consistent, but it would change the emotional resonance of what it did.
And it would definitely be too on the nose.
Right.
Yeah. Definitely two on the nose. Ha ha, look at how prescient I am. I can see into the future.
This does make me want to reread Falling Man. Maybe I didn't give DeLillo enough credit for what he did with 9/11.
Well, isn't the reason, because I started reading that, but I think the criticism that I remember you levying, and I think that it did actually kind of stop me from finishing it.
Oh, no.
Was that it was too saccharine, too sincere.
Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
Too sincere?
Well, I mean, sincere is the wrong word.
Saccharine? Because saccharine sounds sweet in a... artificial or maudlin kind of way.
Well, it's...
Sincere doesn't necessarily connote the same thing.
Yeah, sincere is the wrong word. Disregard sincere.
My recollection
Erase it from
of it.
Your memory.
Well, it's my recollection of it was that there's not a lot to it, and it didn't really seem like he quite knew what to say about it yet, right? It's about these characters. None of the characters have a particularly... It's really deeply impacted their lives, but in ways that are inexpressible and not incredibly rational. And that's very distinct from a lot of DeLillo, where he's always very happy to have his characters monologue about the themes that he's writing about, right? And the fact that in Falling Man, his characters do not monologue about what it all means suggests... I had the sense that he felt like he had to write a 9/11 novel, and he had these kind of stories that were suggesting themselves to him, but he didn't yet have enough space from it or enough understanding to really be able to write. And so maybe that's one difference between, for fiction writers, maybe that's one difference between World War II and 9/11, right? Like with World War II, the day it was over, we knew pretty well what it had meant, right? And... the impact that it would have on history. And there's a whole set of stories that were there was a popularly held idea about World War II and what it meant that was immediately set in place, and so you could have things like Catch-22 and Gravity's Rainbow pretty quickly come along and start to kick that over, right? And I mean, Gravity's Rainbow came out in 73, and that is a novel that just completely demolishes the kind of binary good over evil moral arc that we told ourselves about World War II. And
Since when were the Americans not the fucking heroes of World War II, Hans? You're blowing my mind here.
Right, right. Yeah, it's old news at this point. But like, are you familiar with Gravity's Rainbow at all, Patrick?
No, I mean.
Well, the basic idea.
I'm aware of it.
I'm going to oversimplify a bit here, right? But
you have to oversimplify Gravity's Rainbow.
But the idea.
I still haven't finished it. I've read about three quarters of it.
Oversimplified in a way that makes me want to read it.
Okay. Well, the idea of Gravity's Rainbow is that World War II was actually the military-industrial complex fighting against itself for its own profit, and it won. That's if you take that as your guiding light, then I don't think Pynchon would be too angry if he found out that I summarized it that way, right?
The military industrial complex is fighting against itself for its own profit, and it won. Okay.
Right.
sounds good. sounds hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah.
What happened?
And I mean the amount of time
Go on. I have a question about this, but go on.
The amount of time that's elapsed between 9/11 and today is now the same, I believe, as the amount of time that's elapsed between World War II and Gravity's Rainbow being published, right? And he started writing Gravity's Rainbow 10 years before he published it. So like,
sure,
there's enough time has happened that we could have novels that are addressing it with the scale and complexity and depth that Gravity's Rainbow addressed World War II. But to my knowledge, we don't really. And I wonder if part of that is that there's not really any popular sense yet. There's like the idea of what 9/11 meant and how it kind of shaped history thereafter isn't clearly set enough to be writing a really strong counter narrative even, right?
I have a different theory.
Okay.
We know exactly what happened. World War II was large and complicated and multi-perceptual enough for it to be a lattice to carry and still carry stories and mm-hmm. and have people explore and you could imagine like a BuzzFeed article, the top 20 never told stories of World War II.
Sure. That's a good point. Yeah.
That come out. Yeah. But like 9/11, we know exactly there's no space. There's no air for it.
I guess. I guess the thing that is interesting about 9/11 isn't so much what happened on that day as what the long-term ramifications would be, right? I suppose in some sense something like, I don't know, the movie Zero Dark Thirty, right? Like that's a 9/11 movie, even though 9/11 doesn't, as I recall, doesn't actually happen in it. It's about 9/11 in a pretty basic way. So maybe any kind of novel that's about, maybe something like, I know that we didn't air this podcast, but The Locals by Jonathan Dee, right? That's a 9/11 novel.
Yeah.
Even though 9/11... Well, actually, that is very much a 9/11 novel. I'm surprised I didn't mention that. Maybe I didn't mention that because we, again, found that to be kind of semi-successful and not as coherent as it could have been.
But that's kind of a horrifying thought, actually, because, like, sure, World War II stories, there were World War II stories set after the war that looked back on the war, but it seems like what you're saying is that 9/11 stories, like, you could say that a story that's told in New York is it has to acknowledge 9/11 in some way, and at what, and maybe that, maybe just acknowledging 9/11 doesn't make it a 9/11 story, but it, we're like, we're in the lens, the lens of 9/11 has basically washed so much of the future in the light of what happened, that it's like, I don't know, like, maybe it's the same with any big historical event. Maybe, like, maybe all stories were Holocaust stories for like 20 years or so after World War II. That's just kind of, that actually kind of makes me feel a little claustrophobic.
Right.
About, maybe it's, you know, like storytelling these days.
Well, and that is a character, that is, I mean, that's a characteristic of that, that device, I think, is characteristic of one way that you see people frame narratives now, right? Like the New York Times had that whole issue on slavery that a series of, I can't remember what it was called, like the 1619 Project, something like that. But like the thesis of this series of articles was that everything that has happened in American history is that white supremacy and slavery are so profoundly tied in with American history that like all stories of American history are slavery stories, right?
Sure.
And that's, I mean, and I don't want to argue with that. I'm not saying that that's not accurate, right? But it's, you could also say that all American stories are stories about economics, right? Or that the whole, you know, like every story that happens, every story that's set in America after the 50s is a highway story, right? Because the geographic life of America was, you know, like the highway system so deeply changed the geographic life of America, right? And I mean, I don't mean to trivialize the way that the 1619 Project, if I'm getting that title right, I don't mean to trivialize the way that it's approaching race and slavery, because clearly, like, those are of greater urgency than the highway system. But the kind of framework of saying, okay, well, actually, every story is a this story is, I'm only trying to say that that is, it's a distinct, it's a lens that seems to be in favor in a lot of analysis right now.
Well, and
yeah,
and every story can be a this story if you create a wide enough framework.
So it might be that we're in danger. Yeah, exactly, Patrick. It might be that we're in danger, or that I put us in danger by selecting these works when I did, of over-determining 9/11, right? Or allowing it to maybe tempting us to cast a frame in which it's actually more important than it is. I was thinking last night, as I was preparing for this podcast, there was an idea for a while after 9/11 that was like the day everything changed, TM copyright. And did everything change, right? And if so, what changed? And how do you know? And obviously we still care about all the petty bullshit we cared about in the mid to late 90s, right? Even if we're a little bit less offended by Eminem and Marilyn Manson. And in some ways we care about a lot more petty bullshit. But I don't know, I kept thinking, like, you know, like my parents were basically politically apathetic before 9/11. They were politically apathetic with very slight leanings toward libertarianism and a certain kind of cosmopolitan liberalism. And then after 9/11, they were just immediately hardcore Republicans and never really stopped being in one way or another. And if the story of the breakdown of American social life or American social fabric in the last 20 years has been everybody's got to have a strong opinion about everything, everything is political, the NFL is political now, right? Everything is, there's nothing that is allowed to be politically neutral ground, and more like political disinterest or apathy are not, they're morally bad, and centrism is a certain kind of, like, centrism has become in a lot of circles, sort of a very dirty word, right? And that's if that arc is the arc of American social and political life, a lot of things set that in motion. But in my own observed experience, 9/11 was very key in really being the accelerant that pushed that in from the realm of very glacial trend into crisis. Which
I think
maybe somebody should write a novel about that. I guess The Locals, in some sense, was also a novel about that. It was just not a very good one.
Well, I think that, like, if we're trying to diagnose society, or like to do like a health checkup on society and see if there was some sort of like trauma that changed how, see if 9/11 actually changed how society functions. Like, I guess if, like, I'm saying this in an awkward way, I'll just say it simpler. If enough people are convinced that it mattered, then it matters.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where we're at, you know, like it's, we've given it, that power and to an extent now where it's sort of, it's been so invested with power that that it's dangerous to question whether we should have, or dangerous even to suggest that, enough time has passed, we can start making, sort of gentle jokes, or we can begin to de-escalate our sensitivity about it. Because I do think you named a bunch of things that, like all American stories are about the highway system, and yeah, all American stories are about American love for cars, and all American stories are about American exceptionalism, and all American stories are about slavery, and all of those things refract over each other, and they create, lots of different useful frameworks and lattice for storytellers to use, and all that's great. I do think that 9/11 is diminished by association. Basically, all of those are more important mechanically, like in terms of like human life lost, and commerce made or spread, or people personally touched. Right. 9/11 is a strange thing to elevate up to that level. Right. Because it killed a few thousand people, it was, as of right now, thankfully, really a singular thing, and maybe that kind of helps it. But it is a strange event to lift up to that level, and I don't know that makes it. That makes it even weirder to me. Like, I don't know. Well, all of those other things are, they just seem much more powerful for reasons that I understand.
And Patrick, maybe that has something to do with your feeling that the use of 9/11 at the end maybe wasn't effective, right? The sense that by wrapping this story around 9/11 that doesn't have to be wrapped around 9/11. Maybe you're giving it one effect of that is to give that event a kind of primacy that it doesn't, that the event itself maybe doesn't really have in the narrative of American life. Or am I reading too much into your thoughts?
No. I think that's fair, and I think that generally speaking, I think the, well, I don't know exactly how to speak generally, but I feel like the narrative that this country has taken away from what happened on 9/11 is the wrong one. Rather than, as evidence of a history of imperialism that culminates in, like, an attack, this is a point at which freedom-hating brown people, want to take our lives away or whatever.
Right.
Seems to be the, like, what we've drawn out of this story. And I find, like, the patriotic narrative that most people have taken out of 9/11 to be very problematic. And so whenever something is associated with 9/11, I'm reminded of that. So that might be playing into it as well.
Even if these two particular works don't really tie into that narrative.
Right.
Partly because they are 9/11 is so paradoxically so peripheral and yet so central in.
Right. It's seemingly so peripheral. And so when you've got such an important subject where, so many people have misinterpreted it and taken the wrong narrative away from it. It seems like if you're just kind of use it as a technique, that seems problematic to me.
That's fair.
I think that makes a lot of sense, especially with Moshfegh's story, because it's, I guess if you're looking for a more, like, a clearer vector for what that ending means for the protagonist, for any larger statements about the country, it's really hard right now to separate, like, because even though we know exactly, we know in excruciating detail what happened on 9/11, it refracts in so many strange ways, and a lot of those ways are questionable. So, like, for her to kind of project Reva onto the woman who's jumped out of the building and kind of fill it with, hope is the wrong word, but, like, animus and awakeness and awareness, it feels to me, especially talking to you guys, like I don't want to trust her.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was having a similar thought, which was that, so in some sense, the narrator claims to have, if I was understanding it correctly, the narrator claims to have actually found the period of full self-annihilation that she goes through at the end of the novel. She claims to have actually emerged from that, in some sense awakened, right? And I mean, she gets on the one thing that has been kind of a running thread through the novel is that she refuses to sell her parents' house. That's her way of clinging to that past. And at the end of the novel, she gets on the phone and she says, okay, well, you know what, sell the house. But so she is presenting, the narrator is presenting her own story as actually one of self-actualization and growth out of the pit that she has spent most of the novel being stuck in. But then what does this new person do with the world? She looks at a woman falling out of 9/11 and says, there is a model of wakefulness and clarity. I find that inspiring, right? That's a terrible response. But sure. I'm sure that Moshfegh is aware that that's, well, I don't know, I'm not sure, but it's hard not to think that Moshfegh is aware that that's a terrible response, right? That the idea of that ending maybe isn't so much that it's not really about 9/11 at all. It's about the narrator's going from a kind of, going from, the narrator has transitioned actually into a new framework of, a new mental framework of a certain kind of vapidity, which she thinks of as wakefulness, right?
That's interesting. Yeah, I definitely questioned whether, the narrator's year of rest actually worked, as if she'd come out of it as
emerging from a cocoon.
Yeah, yeah. That I kept saying the word chrysalis in my head, and I couldn't get it out. Right. But like the shallow take is that she does emerge from the cocoon, and she is doing better. But I actually like that take that you're saying, Hans, is she emerges from the cocoon, but the problem is now is that she is the vapid thing that she has kind of been criticizing and hating on throughout the novel.
Yeah, and her kind of goal, like her goal is terrible. Her goal, even though her parents, her mom especially, kind of sucked, you know.
yeah.
But I guess, you know, she has this moment where she admits to herself or to her doctor that she killed her mother, which I don't know if it's explicitly. I mean, I guess I trust her in that moment. It seems like it's a moment to trust her. But all that aside, like her goal is to basically like get rid of all of the feelings, you know, and as though the feelings are something that are poisoning her. And I guess that is, you know, maybe a goal that you would have if you're surrounded by people like Trevor and her mother. And, you know, Riva is trying very hard and, you know, but I don't know, like she's on this side of the experience of feelings where just basically feelings give her, cause her pain. Mm-hmm. And that retreat from feelings is awful. Like it's a terrible goal. I think, you know, you could use intercontext. You could use other texts. You know, like I think the title story in The Things They Carried is basically about like a Vietnam like soldier like eventually reaching a point where he doesn't care anymore. And he feels good about it, but it's, you know, it's bad. That's a bad thing.
Right.
And, you know, for her to reach this point, and she's kind of, I think she's like sitting in lotus position in a room without furniture at some point at the very end, right. Or that's what it sounds like to me, where, you know, she's reached this ascetic point where she can just sort of get rid of her childhood home and look at, basically the avatar, if not actually her friend, jumping out of a building and admire it. That's like, that's terrible. It's a bad, bad place to be.
Mm. Right.
Sure. I believe it.
Cool. Well, we solved it, guys.
Yeah.
That's good. It's, hey, you know, I always like it when we solve it.
I don't think I've felt like we solved it since Naked Singularity, which I think was maybe the second one we did. So it's been a while.
Yeah, we solved that one, and this one we solved, definitely. This is great. This is a fantastic feeling.
Well,
all right.
Is it your turn, Patrick?
Yeah, it's my turn.
What are you picking?
are you picking nits?
No, I'm not nitpicking. I've talked to you guys about this book before, and I think I'm ready to read it again for the fourth time or something. So I'm gonna go with The Fall by Albert Camus.
Oh, and nice.
It's a short novel. It's less than 200 pages, I think. So I was hoping I could also scan a portion of a critical text that deals with the novel and send that along to you as well.
Sure.
It's a chapter from Ronald Aronson's biography of Camus and Sartre. And, well, it's not a full biography of Camus and Sartre. It's a it's the story of how they became friends, and then, you know, the conflict that led to their split. And the section on the fall reads it totally in the context of this split, this actual split that Camus and Sartre had. And I always found the reading, the critical Aronson's critical reading, interesting, engaging, but also somewhat lacking. At least from a biographer's point of view, it's fine. From a literary student's point of view, I feel like that's the point of view it's lacking. But I think it would be like a good supplemental text just to give you some background, because I think it's a mega difficult text. Not mega difficult to read. Like, Camus' style is very plain and simple and easy to read. But, like, you know, this is one of those ones that I feel like we're not going to solve and can't be solved. But it's a good book. So, yeah, The Fall.
All right.
Cool.
Excellent.
Look forward to it.
All right. Cool. Thank you guys for joining me as usual. And readers, or excuse me, listeners, stay tuned for the next episode, which will be on Albert Camus' The Fall. Peace out, everyone.
See you around.
Bye.
See ya.